Good afternoon, everybody. And thank you. Welcome to the session 5B on third-party data governance, meeting expectations and managing risk. You know, following on from this morning's session with Jeremy Hirschhorn and a bit of discussion around, you know, trust within the tax system, justified trust and the expectations of, you know, the role of the ATO in the economy, it only, you know, makes sense that the next reiteration of requirements around quality and of both the data and also the reporting to the ATO, that, you know, listed funds, foreign investments and other corporate actions is a large part of the financial services sector. And so the ever-increasing complexity of investment products and also reliance on outsourced service providers is becoming an ever-increasingly important area. So to cover off on this topic today, we've got Aaron Bennett from the ATO and I'm Rob Leonard from PwC.
Good afternoon, everyone. So my name is Aaron Bennett and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Private Capital Program in the ATO's Public Groups business line. So today's session focuses on third-party data governance. So as part of the Private Capital Program, that program includes our collective investment vehicle, so our managed investment trusts and attribution managed investment trust strategy team, as well as our top 1,000 combined assurance review team, so the team that actually undertakes the combined assurance reviews in the managed fund space, which is what the relevance is for the program for the third-party data governance. So we work on the guide along with our colleagues in our super area and insurance area in the ATO. So today I'll be presenting with Rob. So we've got an hour, so the way we thought we'd break it up is I'll speak for 15 to 20 minutes or so, Rob will speak for 20 minutes or so, which will, everything going to plan, will give us lots of time for questions at the end. So, and my presentation here broadly will go cover four areas, the first being just the ATO expectations around third-party data governance and the guide, some observations we can make, given that we've now been reviewing it for a few years, or reviewing third-party data governance for a few years as part of our combined assurance reviews. I'll just touch on a few areas of focus for the ATO in considering the guide, and I'll also finish off with just a few comments around in-house service providers, because I know that's something that people are interested in. To get started, I thought I'd just kind of provide a bit of a timeline for where we began and where we are now. So with justified trust more broadly, that's been around now for 10 or so years. This is obviously part of that program, but about 2015 or 2016 was when we identified the need for some third-party data governance guidance for the industry, given the significance of third-party data for managed funds, insurance companies, and super funds, and so financial services more broadly. So that was identified as part of that process. We consulted extensively with industry over the subsequent few years from 2015 through to around 2018. Then we developed a guide, the supplementary guide that sits alongside the broader tax governance framework guide, and that was released in 2022. So it was released in 2022, and then there was a transition period before it was formally applied in our assurance program. So from 2022 to 2024, we did consider it as part of our assurance program, but we didn't formally rate or provide a formal assurance rating. We did provide feedback and comments to entities, but we didn't formally rate it, and that didn't happen until 1 July 2024. But in that time, I think we can say it's been very pleasing to see how much focus there has been on developing third-party data governance and the improvements that have been made since the release of the guide through to what we're seeing now in our assurance program. So I'll touch a bit more on what we're doing from the start of 1 July 2024 in a minute, but just up there you can see it's 2027 and beyond. So obviously the guide came out 2022, it'll be around, it has been out now for nearly 5 years, 4 to 5 years. So we are, as we do with a lot of products, considering whether changes need to be made. As we go through our review products, we ourselves look and see whether there could be improvements or additions in terms of better practice examples or changes to what's in the guide. But at the same time, we do welcome any comments or feedback from industry through different processes to let us know where you think there need to be changes. So please do reach out if you do have any suggested changes or comments. So obviously, governance over third-party data remains a key focus area for the ATO across the investment industry, so including managed funds, super funds, and insurance companies. For managed funds, which is the area we deal with mostly, documented third-party data tax control frameworks that have been designed effectively provide a key foundation for our assurance that the correct tax attributes are reported to members and beneficiaries of the funds. Noting that we've had the transitional period in 2022 and then the formal rating from 1 July 2024, our current expectation is that a stage two rating is to be the industry baseline for all investment industries in terms of third-party data. What that means is that effectively we expect the entities to have effectively designed controls in place and commitments to do testing over or do regular testing or periodical testing with the aim to get into each stage through rating over time. So as I said, we have been reviewing third-party data now since 1 July 2024 across our super funds and managed investment trust reviews. So we have got some observations we've made through that process. The key consideration when we assess the design effectiveness of an entity's third-party data tax controls, first, is whether they are fit for purpose for the entity's business and the extent to which it relies on third-party data. So it is very much a principles-based approach, and you take that, review it, and apply it to your specific circumstances. And what we have seen in the reviews we've done today is there is a wide variation in adoption. So it's been a very positive change, as I mentioned at the beginning, as we've moved through the process, but there still is a wide adoption, variation in adoption across funds. Some entities we've actually seen have largely or fully adopted the guide, embedded the controls into their governance frameworks and testing plans, and in some cases have even commenced third-party data testing as well. At the other end of the spectrum, we have also seen entities that still rely almost entirely on the tax reporting provided by custodians or administrators, even where the custodian's tax controls may not be adequate for the certain investment types, particularly for the more complex investment types. So we do see it across both the whole spectrum. In terms of the focus on the administrator's tax controls, we have seen a need for a stronger focus, stronger processes and controls to ensure that the administrator's tax policies are prepared in accordance with tax law and are accurately reflected in the tax reporting relied on by the entities, ultimately relied on by the entities. This is increasingly so in the more complex structures or investments that we're seeing. But at the same time, we do see some positives where we see a number of outsourced service providers engaging independent tax advisors to review their tax policies annually, or when there's been a legislative change that impacts on their reporting. So that has definitely been a positive. A point we'd make here, though, is that in addition to that, we would expect the actual lodging entity, so in this case the MIT or trustee of the MIT or the AMIT, to not only rely on just the independent outsourced service provider, but to also ensure that outsourced service provider's tax policy actually align with their own tax policy. And here we expect that there should be a documented process to identify, review, and resolve any differences between the two at least annually. And this includes identifying any systems or process limitations of the outsourced service provider. So if we're on the next slide, just there, your last point there, you'll see is a key point here is that ultimately the lodgement obligation and the associated rules and penalties and things apply to the lodging entity. So whilst you have an outside service provider, ultimately the responsible entity is the lodging entity. So that's why key focus is on what they do to ensure they're comfortable with what is happening at the outsourced service provider and that it reflects their tax policy statements as well. So the supplementary guide clearly outlines our expectations around third-party data controls. And so we strongly encourage entities to actively take steps to follow it. So a practical way to do this is to work through the better practice examples that are included in the guide, consider whether they apply to your circumstances, and implement them in a tailored way. So here's the important thing, in a tailored way that reflects your unique circumstances. if a compensating control would be more effective, would more effectively mitigate the risk that the better practice example is aimed at mitigating, then you can design and implement this compensating control and just clearly document why and how that has been done. But a key focus there is it is a flexible approach and it's fit for purpose, so you can tailor it to your own circumstances, noting the differences in complexity across different entities and investment types. So some of the error controls and principles where we have seen there could be possible improvements made for a number of funds, which I've identified through our reviews, include in relation to BLC3 or that the board is appropriately informed. So here, reporting templates, processes and procedures must clearly set out the minimum matters for consideration of the board, subcommittee or delegate. This includes reporting on the effectiveness of the third-party data tax control framework, encompassing both internal and external controls that are operated by custodians where relevant. So we expect regular reporting to the board on the performance of outsourced service providers, including where there are breaches of any service level agreements. We have observed that some reporting templates provide little or no details on breaches. What we would expect here, as we go through the reviews, where breaches occur, we would expect the board to be informed of the breach, be informed of how the breach was rectified, and also what controls have been implemented to prevent any recurrence of the breach going forward. Another area where we've seen possible areas for improvement is in relation to BLC4 or periodic internal control testing. So to achieve a stage 2 rating, entities must evidence a commitment to independent periodic internal control testing of their third-party data tax control framework to confirm it's operating as intended. So this is a commitment to undertake the testing over a period of 2 to 3 years. This commitment may be evidenced through a board-endorsed tax policy that includes a testing timeframe, a board-approved testing plan, or written confirmation from the board, a board subcommittee, executive leadership team, or other senior representative or delegate of the board that all key controls will be tested by an appropriate qualified independent reviewer at a defined interval. So we have observed through our reviews some entities including the third-party data tax controls in the scope of their internal tax control testing plan more broadly, and we do encourage entities to implement these testing plans. We should also know that most entities have sought assurance from the outsourced service providers in relation to the accuracy of the data received and processed, for example, via a GS007 form. But we have also found that many of these reports do not include sufficient tax control objectives in the scope of the independent assurance. Here we emphasise that a report where tax control objectives are not included in the scope of the report is not adequate and would not meet the design effectiveness criteria. So here we expect to see evidence that the entities have reviewed the reports to understand the scope of the controls for tax reporting included in the report, as well as understanding the testing methodology. We'd also like to see evidence that entities understand the findings in these reports and that these findings have been reported to the board, and any required remediation strategy has also been reported to the board where exceptions are identified. So this is probably a key area where we have identified need for improvement through our reviews. So to achieve a stage 2 rating, entities must understand the limitations of the independent assurance reports and implement their own documented controls where gaps exist. So these gaps should be raised with outsourced service providers, or alternatively an option is to address these through entity level controls. So another area I just want to touch on quickly is MLC3, so significant transactions are identified. So here we emphasise the importance of adequate controls when entering into investments or transactions that are not subject to straight-through processing. We have observed that most entities define what constitutes a significant or complex investment, which is a positive, and this includes both qualitative and quantitative factors. However, at the same time, we have also noted that clearly defined criteria as to how the complexity of each investment will be assessed, as well as the escalation and sign-off processes, are absent. So there's no clearly defined criteria or processes there. Another thing is, while onboarding tax due diligence for new investments is generally strong, so in respect of new New investments is relatively strong. We have observed that exits or disillusions of complex or significant investments are sometimes overlooked. Here we would expect a post-closure review is essential to confirm the correct tax treatment ultimately adopted. Another key point here we see is in relation to migration of data. So migration of data when there is a change, so an outsourcing of in-house functions or a change in the service provider or a migration of fund accounting or investment platforms, or where in the case of super funds, a successor fund transfer or restructures in the mid-space. So here we expect entities to have documented controls in place covering the planning, testing and migration of the data between different administrators or custodians. And this includes understanding the differences in tax policies, assessing impacts on the tax data and documenting changes to their tax return process as a result. All right, I'll quickly touch on in-house service providers. So we do recognise that some investment entities perform investment and reporting functions in-house rather than through traditional outsourcing arrangements. In many cases, these functions are carried out by a separate legal entity governed by a service level agreement that defines roles, responsibilities and tax reporting deliverables. But here, importantly, the point is the lodging entity is often not the entity that produces the tax reporting. So whilst it is in-house, it is still separate, a separate entity to the reporting entity. So we reiterate here in these circumstances that the use of in-house or outsourced service providers does not remove the legal responsibility of the entity to maintain appropriate checks and balances. And although these arrangements differ from traditional outsourcing, our expectations for third-party data tax controls apply equally between in-house and outsourced service providers. And entities are expected to adapt to the better practice examples in the guide so that the intent of the controls is met in the in-house context, having regard to their specific circumstances. So this expectation is set out in the governance, the guide, supplementary guide that's been released. But here, I think a key point is that the approach, again, is a principles-based approach. So obviously, you recognise the difference in complexity and structures in doing it, but it still is a requirement that you do apply the guide to your circumstances in where it's an in-house service provider. All right, I think that's it. So I might hand over to Rob.
Thanks, Aaron. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Excuse me. My name is Rob Leonard. I'm a director at PwC, where I help tax teams untangle data governance and technology. And so while Aaron today has focused on, the ATO's expectations, I'll be trying to really provide some practical suggestions about how tax managers might navigate the ATO's TPD guide and ensure they can comply with it. So in that direction, I wanted to focus on three key areas. The first being why. Why should we kind of comply with the TPD guide? The second is, how. How should we comply with it? And so a bit of a suggested approach to do that. And then third and finally, some additional considerations that may or may not apply to some of the organisations who are represented in this room, covering specifically international and complex investments. And then secondly, current ATO expectations, which Aaron has kindly kind of talked us through. And then thirdly, that the three A's, I guess, which it seems no presentation in 2026 is complete without. So automation, analytics, and AI. So I'll jump then into the why. So why align with the third party data guide? I think the first thing to call out right is, this is not a piece of tax legislation, as we all know. So although there's no express penalties kind of for non-compliance, I think it's still really in the interest of every kind of entity that's impacted by this guide to have regard to these three factors when they go about complying with the guide. So the first is the promise of a lighter touch approach for ATO reviews. This kind of came out through the differentiated approach guidance in 2024. And it highlighted there'd be two key changes to the way the ATO engages with taxpayers through reviews, specifically that we could expect to see fewer questions and that questions that would be targeted primarily on the last period or the last year in the four-year review period. So there are some exceptions or caveats noted in the brackets on the slides, so specifically around significant transactions or material risks flagged to market, where you would still expect to see all 4 years of the review covered in questions. But that's a significant kind of benefit for taxpayers in terms of why they might apply or apply the expectations in the guide. The next benefit to consider is the next actions that might be called out in your review kind of report. So we just expect there to be less next actions called out in your report where you proactively comply. And so it puts you in the driver's seat where you're able to control how you engage with the ATO by showing that you proactively endeavour to comply with it. And then third, just a really practical benefit to call out, which is that the purpose of the third-party data controls and better practice recommendations in the guidance are not just for their own benefit. They're designed to ensure that there's fewer mistakes in tax compliance and lower risks of errors. And so the suggestion is that in the long run, this is also advantageous to the organisations represented in this room. I think just a couple of things to call out as well in terms of some potential future ATO activity, and this is speculative, but it's based on what we've seen from income tax governance and GST governance. And as Aaron kind of mentioned in his timeline, this has been in the works for a really long time. What we've seen from the ATO is the use of findings reports and other published guidance to articulate where the market's maybe not meeting ATO expectations, communicate where expectations have been clarified or evolved over time, and then introduce levers, incentives, and sticks and carrots to encourage taxpayers to align with their expectations. So I think direction of travel is pretty clear. We could expect to see that trend continue in respect of third-party data governance. And so I hope that provides some kind of suggestions on why we might want to comply with the guide. In the purple box on the screen, there's also an example which speaks to what we've seen in practice, which kind of covers off all three of those areas, which is that in the findings report in 2025, I think September 2025, the ATO called out that where there's a commitment to test made by taxpayers to commit controls and the date in that commitment to test is not met, then the ATO might consider whether a stage two rating for tax governance remains appropriate, and so whether a stage one for tax governance rating might be more appropriate. So you can see how, through findings reports, the ATO is kind of clarifying and evolving expectations, communicating where taxpayers might have fallen short, and then creating incentives and some sticks and potentially carrots to encourage taxpayers to comply with the guide. So I hope that provides, at a glance, just a quick overview of why we should kind of endeavour to comply with this, and some practical consequences where taxpayers may not. I'll then jump along with a suggested approach on how to comply with the guide. So we've kind of articulated five key steps for what taxpayers might want to do when considering how to comply with the guide. The first is to define a goal that you want to achieve, a stage rating you want to achieve, and when you want to achieve it by. So just really practically, in the September findings report that I mentioned, the ATO published some indicators of where the market's at, and Aaron's spoken to that already. But from a sample, I think, of approximately 20 taxpayers that were reviewed, I think 70% had achieved stage two, which is not surprising, given that, as Aaron mentioned, that's, the expectation of the regulator. So I think as a starting point, if you're thinking about establishing a goal of anything less than a stage two or stage three, you would probably be an outlier in the population. And I think the expectation would be to try and target that stage two. And for the purpose of this presentation, I'll kind of assume that's our objective, to achieve at least a stage two or stage three rating for the purpose of the rest of this suggested practical approach. As a second step, the suggestion is you should map your outsourced service providers and the ecosystem that they exist within your organisation. Just really practically, I often have this conversation with clients where they say, all of our OSPs are actually in-house, or, the person who does the accounting or equivalent of a custodian workstream sits opposite me or sits on the floor above me. Why do I need to practically consider and apply, any outsourced service provider controls? And as we heard from Aaron, that the starting point is that the ATO guide applies equally to those in-house service providers. So the suggestion is that you should include those in this step where you can map out those outsourced serviced providers. I think the key point here is within an organisation, it might not be as clean as simply one investment manager performing functions for all funds. And I think sometimes what I've seen with clients is that we can kind of reduce this to, well, you know, I have practical responsibility for this, and so that's enough. But the point is that we should consider, you know, all the things that Aaron talked about, service level agreements, you know, right through to, you know, the controls that we have in place when we're kind of engaging in this step. I think step three, then, kind of document your data sources and processes for your income tax returns, distributions, etc. And so the suggestion is that you should have in one place your end-to-end map of what your process looks like with your key OSPs that relate to those processes and your key data sources as well. Next step then is you should collate your documents that relate to those processes and relate to ATO expectations and perform a gap analysis against them to evaluate whether they conform to ATO expectations. You should then use that gap analysis to provide a remediation roadmap, which you can then use to report to your board on what steps you've taken to fill those gaps and then to perform controls testing. You'll also just note that it's a bit of a cycle, and the reason for that is because, as we've kind of spoken to, you know, we've seen that the ATO is kind of reviewing this guidance next year, that they've used findings reports and other pieces of information to update their expectations or clarify their expectations. And so the suggestion is that you should also kind of approach this as part of a living process to make sure that the work you're doing is aligned with current ATO expectations at the time you do it. So I then just wanted to cover off just some practical suggestions on how to kind of consider your gap analysis and consider your controls testing program. Just a few things to call out. So make sure that you're kind of considering informal processes that may exist within the organisation when you're having regard to your gap analysis. You know, there's some examples on the screen, but quarterly meetings with your custodian or administrator that may occur but may not be documented. If you can just pull together agenda that outline what information you're preparing, that would be, you know, a step in the right direction. Similarly, considering the scope of your ASAE 3402 or GS 007 reports, and as Aaron mentioned, considering whether you might be able to work with your internal teams to expand the scope of those reports to better align with tax controls where relevant. Consider reviewing those reports from a tax perspective. Consider reporting those findings to the board. You know, those sorts of steps, some of which may happen internally, you know, the suggestion is document those in your tax risk management framework and through the gap analysis, kind of explore what's within your organisation's appetite to formalise as an annual or recurring process. Similarly, that second dot point, we acknowledge that a lot of the time these controls aren't within the direct purview of the tax function. So, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. The suggestion is, you know, work with other parts of the business where relevant that might have direct touch points with outsourced service providers or manage custodian, administrator or other relationships, manage service level agreements and leverage those documents where possible so that you can effectively save yourself a bit of time and comply with the guide at the same step. Also just wanted to talk through just a couple of quick suggestions on controls testing. So three quick wins, I guess, or three quick things to think about. So where possible, as Aaron kind of mentioned, you know, have regard to your existing controls testing that occurs throughout the organisation and where relevant within the OSP. So consider whether you have already documented controls for your income tax processes and whether you can map those to the expectations in the third-party data guide and then uplift the controls testing plan to align with that. Similarly, you know, the next suggestion, next dot point, the ATO in the findings report in September clarified what it expected from an independent tester and what independence means in the context of control testing. So broadly, that's, you know, that they can't be the control owner, that they can't be doing the control, so they can't be preparing the return or reviewing the distribution, and that they can't have designed the controls. So really important to have regard to those definitions of independence when kind of engaging someone to prepare or execute a controls testing engagement so that you can ensure that you're not jeopardizing any of chances of getting a stage three rating. And then a third point, just make sure that your results of those control testing engagements are reported to the board. So we often see or have conversations where clients say, well, our board audit committee expectations are summary level, traffic light, red flag only, or red issues only. And so the ATO's expectations are pretty clear. You know, need to make sure that we communicate more than just exceptions only reporting. And the suggestion is that, you know, you should table those detailed reports where possible to ensure that you're meeting the ATO's expectations around BLC3. All right, so that was a bit of a flyover of five quick steps and some practical considerations for how to apply and comply with the guide. But there's just three extra kind of considerations that I just wanted to talk through. The first is the ATO's expectations on complex and international investments, and I totally acknowledge that not all of these will apply to everyone in this room, so suggestion is have regard to and the areas that the ATO has called out in the third-party data guide. So things like corporate limited partnerships, foreign hybrid limited partnerships, FITOs, foreign trusts, CFCs. Identify if there are any investment vehicles that kind of meet that definition. Pick up the third-party data guide, which includes really detailed control procedures for those types of investments, and then evaluate whether they're appropriate, those better practice recommendations are appropriate to apply in your organisation. You'll see that in the diagram on the right, there's kind of three themes that Aaron called out around what those controls and better practice recommendations look like. And broadly, it's that on onboarding, ongoing monitoring and exit, make sure that you have detailed controls over the tax treatment and characterization, data being reported, and your steps in place to review those information. So there's some detailed expectations there, but broadly, as we say, those are the three areas. There are really, really detailed prescriptive steps in the guide, particularly for CLPs. I think there's a 7-step distribution review checklist, which is suggested to have regard to. So suggestion is you should pick up the guide, make sure that if you have any of those investment areas, they're the subject of additional procedures. So Aaron's helpfully called out these areas in his current ATO focus area. I just wanted to put a really practical lens on each of these. So in the findings report in September, there were these five key areas called out. And so as Aaron kind of said, board reporting templates, really important to include, to update those to include, information around SLA breaches. And if there are no SLA breaches in a reporting period, potentially include a positive statement to that effect so that there's no ambiguity when it comes to your ATO review and providing those board reporting templates about what is given to the ATO. Aaron also referred to the ASAE 3402 or GS007 reports. And so, as Aaron mentioned, just make sure these are scoped for tax controls and that they're reviewed and the findings are the subject of remediation plans where there's any gaps that are called out. So, for example, where there's complex or foreign investments, which could be the subject of controls or could be kind of managed through those reports, the suggestion is that that could be a really helpful kind of starting place. Next one, so OSP, information technology systems. So I think the best way to address this, or one way to kind of potentially address this, is to pick up your detailed procedure documents or your process flow documents or your manuals that you use to outline the steps in your processes, and just make sure that they capture accurately the subsystems used by OSPs, the technology used by OSPs, and that they reflect current state. We often see that these documents can sit on the shelf for a little bit, and so there's an opportunity just to review those and make sure that they're up to date and aligned with what OSPs are using. Significant or complex investments. So I think just to make this really practical, it's just worth looking at your tax risk management framework significant transaction section and making sure that where you have complex or foreign transaction or investments of the types that we called out earlier, that those would meet the escalation and definition criteria in your significant transactions, in your definitions in your tax risk management framework. And where they don't, just update those sections or consider whether you might refine the wording to better capture those types of investments. And finally, as Aaron mentioned as well, just making sure that there's a review of your OSP tax policies and making sure that they align with the entity's tax policies where relevant as well. So third and final additional consideration, analytics, automation, and AI. So the guide specifically focuses on that middle A, the analytics. And so in the table, there's some suggestions around areas you might want to explore analytics or explore outliers, explore reconciliations that you might want to automate. So I think this is now kind of done a lot of the time. And so often, as advisors, we kind of do this as part of our tax services where we pick up our investment management reports and make sure they kind of can be reconciled back to custodian reports and the like. But the suggestion is you should document these controls in your risk and control matrix to make sure that the detail is captured and that the process is included in your documentation. And just a final word of caution as well, which is that although you have, open to you to use this technology, it of course doesn't remove the entity's responsibility for correct lodgement. So make sure that you can demonstrate review of these analytics and updates where anomalies are detected or issues are flagged. All right, so this presentation has tried to be the really practical, grounded kind of how-to approach to make sure that you can implement the expectations of the third-party data guide. So some suggested key takeaways. The first is document your plan. So start with your goal, document your plan, outline exactly what you're going to do and by when, and then try and stick to it as best you can. Start with what you have. Most of your documentation or processes may already exist somewhere in the organisation, and so have regard to that rather than reinventing the wheel. Maximise your return on effort by picking up the findings report or this presentation and Aaron's presentation and having regard to those kind of five key areas that were called out in the findings report. Use tech to support your review of transaction-level data, but make sure you document it as part of your controls. And then a final comment, which comes through in the third-party data governance guide, which is, the ATO doesn't expect you to achieve stage three tomorrow, but make sure that through your plan you have a way to make progress so that in your next review you can show to the ATO the steps you've taken to achieve compliance with the third-party data guide. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron and Rob. So they've generously allowed a fair bit of time for questions. And so I wanted to throw it back out there if there's any questions. There's none come through on the live Q&A. They really don't want my questions, but I'm happy to ask a couple, get it going. So probably going from what you touched on most recently, Rob, so there's a lot of talk about analytics and AI can sort of help enhance anomalies or error detection and therefore help with the data validation. I guess, have you got sort of, where are you seeing the most effective uses, I guess, of automated analytics in some of the work you've done so far?
Yeah, so I think the starting point is, this is not a one-size-fits-all answer, and I think it's probably true of almost every one of the comments that we've made. The starting point should be to make sure that your OSP relationships are reflected in the types of data analytics you're implementing. Where I have seen this done well is, some of the things that are called out on the screen. And so, you'll see kind of some data analytics suggestions around, just matching franking credits and dividends, matching your CDT discount, validations, looking at your negative tax cost base for CDT assets where relevant. So think about like anomalies or exceptions that kind of would be problems. I know in the ATO guide there's some specific call-outs which maybe Aaron could speak to around, the 45-day holding rule and things like that. The suggestion is kind of look at your
your data that you're relying on for tax, identify where things are covered by GS007 reports and controls already in place within the OSP, and then consider where there are significant anomalies or significant transactions that might be the subject of additional procedures.
I guess the only thing, so in terms of automation, I guess one point to make is that around, I guess, there's still the sense checking afterwards. So, like, to the extent that it does spit out things that do look not right, you should probably keep that in focus too. I think we would, you would expect a level of detail to explain the automation and ensure not just the ATO and the commissioner, but also just the board as to what has actually happened and what is supported. So, we would expect. I can't provide specific. It's obviously, again, going back to its fit for purpose and depends on the specifics of the case. But, we would definitely, I think, expect to see some level of documentation around the process for automation and how it works.
Do you have any?
So that makes sense. And so to make that really practical, I would go back to what documentation you have already, whether that's a detailed procedure document, a detailed manual, or a process flowchart, a data flowchart, and consider where you can tag controls in those documentation that reflect the automation that you have. I wouldn't expect the ATO to be too interested. I don't want to speak to Aaron, but I wouldn't expect them to be super interested in any detailed technical documents where you kind of spell out the specific, the specific technical code that was used. It's open, of course, for you to do that. But I suggest that where you get the most bang for buck is spelling out the test that you performed, the data sources that you used to inform those tests, the software that was used to perform those tests, and then the human layer at the end of those tests, as Aaron mentioned, where you perform a validation and sense check of the result and apply that tax judgment to understand and communicate that the outcome aligns with what you'd expect.
Probably adding to that, probably just from a practical perspective, that sort of documentation and outlining expectations, it kind of then turns into, a how-to guide to a degree, because obviously staff turnover, people changing, things evolving happens. And speaking more about justified trust and CAR documents, a lot of those become quite helpful tools when trying to, mentor and bring on new staff throughout the periods as well. Further, so with respect to trying to pick some nice questions here. please go ahead. Cheryl? Oh, no, you got one too. Go ahead.
And it is a bit of a follow-on from the last one, but I'm, I suppose, representing one of the IT systems of those OSPs. So are you seeing some really good practices, recommended practices, or where the current standard is there of how we proactively provide, these are the controls that you're getting when you're using our system, this is what you can incorporate into your governance documentation?
I'm not sure if you
have. I'm happy to jump in.
Yes.
I'm obviously from an advisor, and so kind of often where we see it is downstream of outputs rather than upstream from the kind of underlying subsystems that are used to produce investment reports or custodian reports. And I'm not sure which part of the industry you're from, sorry. Happy to talk about it separately as well, if helpful. But what I've seen, right, is kind of point-to-point solution in a very classic consulting way, where at the end of a process, we kind of pull together the reports, validate that they tell the same story, the data is matching and aligning with expectations. So it's downstream detective controls is kind of what I've seen predominantly occur. I do know there is a push to move those tests onto or upstream of the ERP or effectively of, your subsystems. So I think the more that happens, obviously that's closer to source and therefore better practice is what I'd suggest, right? Is that kind of what you were driving towards?
How to follow on a little bit, sorry. The differentiator approach and kind of comparative speaking, I suppose, of who this world and the various questions, how a lot of the language was a little bit expect to
So with the differentiated approach, it is actually, you will hopefully be seeing less questions. Obviously, again, it does turn on the specifics of the entity, but the approach is more tailored where we do, to the extent, depending on where the entity falls in the categorization of in the pool, but also whether they've been reviewed before. So we do take all that into account in the current review. So you should be seeing less questions, but again, it will be a case-by-case basis. But the whole idea of the differentiated approach is to be a lighter touch, take into account what we've already done and the engagements we've had and where you sit in the market. So yes, you should be seeing less. But if you haven't, by all means, tell us. But that the idea of the differentiated approach is to have a lighter touch where we've got assurance previously.
And as someone who's seen a lot of clients receive, you know, car RFIs, like, it's definitely borne out in practice that where you're that medium or high assurance rating, of which, you know, your third party governance stage rating is but one part, you will kind of see just fewer questions and a focus more on the most recent year in your review period. So I'm definitely seeing them in practice from what I can see.
So my question relates to in-house third party, particularly where you have, for example, a super app which is sitting kind of alongside an ordinary IDPS wrap, and the operator itself will have already in place significant tax controls and frameworks, and the trustee will obviously be a different entity as it's required to do. I appreciate everything that's been said, but I'd be curious to understand a bit more about what the expectation is in terms of treating the in-house provider as third party, particularly when a lot of the tax governance and controls are kind of wrapped up in one package. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to express?
So I appreciate, like, in an in-house sort of environment, you're not going to have necessarily the same reports and things that sit outside if it is an outside service provider. So going back to the point about it being a fit for purpose, obviously you do tailor it to the arrangement. So in circumstances where there isn't the same level of documentation, we would still expect, I guess, try to get to the same outcome in terms of the controls. So you don't have to have the exact same, so external report, GS007, or whatever, if it's not available, but you would still need to have some sort of documentation to kind of reflect that outcome. So, so the documentation will be different, but the ultimate goal, I guess, would be the same.
Thank you.
Thank you. From a general insurance perspective, if you look at the investment portfolio, it's weighted towards high grade, liquid, fixed interest securities to meet policy liabilities. It's an APRA requirement. So basically, interest income. That's the investment profile of a general insurer. We have a custodian that looks after our portfolio. Pretty vanilla. And we've talked about engaging third-party testing, reporting to the board. I wonder, be interested in your reactions to that kind of investment profile and the expectations, particularly when you sort of wrap it up with TOFA as well, and investment income is ultimately part of the audit, the third party audit.
Do you want to take it from an industry perspective first? I think in terms of what we'd expect, so again, it's a tailored approach, so it would be specific to the fund, but we would still encourage the This is around testing, sorry. Like in terms of the test, we still would encourage the testing is still part of the requirement under the guide in terms of when we do the assurance reviews. So we appreciate maybe it's not that the complexity may not be there, but that means it can be tailored in a way that's not as complex. But we would still expect to see some level of testing.
Expectation to incur costs to get a third party review, even though it's a low risk profile, the expectation is still there.
In terms of the review, it's an independent review, so it can be independent within the organisation. It's not necessarily needs to be a third party. It just has to have that independence that Rob spoke to around having insurers independent. But yeah, I think it's just the independent testing that's. So I appreciate the point around the costs. So yeah, it's independence as opposed to necessarily third party.
Yeah, I think as Aaron said, the ATO guide expectations are kind of clear, which is that insurers are caught within the scope of the guide, and so the investment profile doesn't go to whether the expectations apply, but I think what it goes to is the types of controls that would be appropriate for your organisation. And so specifically, the guide does call out that where you have high volume transactions of the same nature, can you use a GS007 report or other more general control to manage that risk? And so what the ATO guide says is, if you don't want, if your control is not appropriate for your organisation, document on an if not, why not basis. It's not appropriate, is what the guide says. And so, so long as I think you have documented that, you're better than not having done that exercise. Obviously, best practice is to comply with all the better practice expectations in the guide. But yeah, I take your point that for insurers, I have seen this play out, that for insurers with, low risk appetites, like it can be challenging.
Just one more question. In relation to specifically BLC3, so BLC3F, it specifically requires board attestation. We do our third-party data controls, checks, etc., report to the board. We fail to understand as to, once it's reported to the board, they are aware, what specific attestation is required, because that's quite specific under BLC3F, and it comes up every time you go through it and you struggle to do anything additional to get attestation from the board.
Happy to. Yeah. So I can't speak to, I think there's two parts to your question. I think the first is, what is the rationale behind at BLC 3F? And I can't obviously speak to that. What I can help with is practically what I have seen clients do in relation to that. So the first thing I have seen is that as part of an annual report, where relevant, there may be a broader statement around the board's comfort or the audit committee's comfort with the broader control environment within the organisation, and that tax forms a part of that. So that could be one way to address this. Another way, and it's a compensating control, not a board statement, but a compensating control could be to highlight where management has attested to the board that the processes it has undertaken to get comfortable about the tax control environment and the controls in respect of third-party data and OSPs. So the suggestion is, from a practical perspective, those are two ways you might go about it, but I might let others speak to the kind of intention behind that. I can't really cover that part.
I think in terms of, informing the board and what level of, I guess, recognition or acknowledgement from the board as to what has happened? Is that
what's going to happen? There's a specific attestation requirement under 3F. What else does the board need to do? They have seen, we have already, they have seen the findings. What else do they need to do to comply with 3F, which is attestation?
I think, going to Rob's point around, I guess in circumstances where changes have been made, it's acknowledgement and recognition of those changes, I guess, to the extent where there are identified gaps or issues that need to be reported and there's nothing coming back, I guess, in that circumstance, it's more, I guess, more just around recognition of what has actually been implemented to address the concerns, and then recognition from the board that, that's been put in place. I can't speak to... Pardon?
There's two parts to it. One is reporting, so perhaps reporting is sufficient. Is that
what you're trying to say? No, I guess, again, without me constantly saying it's a facts and circumstances, which I'm prone to do in most things I talk about, I think, yeah, it would turn on, I guess, at least some sort of recognition from the board, what that form would take. I'm sorry, I can't speak to it, but happy to take this. If you want, we could take this offline as well, and I can provide further guidance.
Probably a question for Aaron. What's the process for this year, the target for this year for rolling out further third-party governance reviews? Because you've just completed the 24-25 ones, gone through about 20. So who's on target this year?
So I can speak probably more to the managed investment trust space around what we're doing. So I think we're on target. So around, I think there's around 22 reviews that will be we're doing this year towards 30 June. And those are those ones that will be to be completed this year are well, obviously, they've commenced and are well progressed and will be finalised this year. And then I think there's probably another similar amount next year that will go, and it'll be obviously a rolling basis, but they'll commence within the next 6 months or so to then finalise by 30 June 2027. So at this stage from the managed investment trust space, around 24 or so reviews to be completed by 30 June.
Okay. We've covered a lot today. So with the remaining 4 minutes, Rob or Aaron, maybe what is probably the key sort of takeaway, or maybe it's, you know, what's the most underestimated challenge when it comes to the TPD based on your consulting, Rob, and I guess Aaron, the reviews? What's kind of the key message you'd like to leave this afternoon with?
I think the key message is that we've actually seen, significant improvements, and industry have really engaged with the third-party data guidance. And we have, so I think Rob spoke to the number of stage two ratings, and that is the industry or the ATO's expectation, but we are seeing that generally. So it's been very positive, the engagement. I guess more broadly, the point to make, as Rob pointed to, is that going forward in relation to the testing, so a lot of people are at stage two now, obviously want to get to stage three. Stage two is a commitment to testing. Stage three is doing the testing and then considering the testing results. A key point to note that this is a journey. Governance is a journey, including third-party governance. And whilst it's a journey progressing forward, to the extent, and we haven't really seen this yet, but we would need to start seeing going forward the testing coming through, I guess, is a key point. Seeing that testing and then... it's not that it's a stage, it's not a set and forget sort of thing. It's a journey that's constantly going. So I guess the next big step is doing that testing.
And I think, your question, Matt, was around, challenges. I think we've heard in the room today, some of those challenges that I think, I hear from clients every day around, kind of why does this guide apply to my set of circumstances in a low risk or internal in-house environment. So that's, I think, one set of challenges. I think another set of challenges that we haven't explored as much is around defining the controls in place for OSPs and third-party data that are the subject of supplementary risk and control matrices. And I think getting those right is just a really practical thing that will depend on the entities in question. If I were to compare this to the income tax TRG guide, which contains really prescriptive, detailed sub-procedures of the kind you've kind of called out with, BLC 3F and 3G and et cetera, with really detailed sub-procedures, I have seen that entities can sometimes, it takes time to develop the right test procedures and control procedures in the context of third-party data, because the guidance is just that little bit more high level because of the nature of the diverse taxpayers that are covered by the guidance. So that's, I think, a challenge area. So I guess the takeaway is make a start, and then you'll get feedback through the CAR process, I guess, on gaps would be my suggestion.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Aaron and Rob.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you.
So we're moving back into the main room. Please remember to fill out the survey, for the session as well. Thank you very much.